So we have Margaret Blaby here to share their story about using the systems for NAS.
Good morning. Actually, Margaret Young.
Oh, sorry. I thought I flipped them.
Margaret. Yeah. So I work here in Alaska with the Division of Public Health in the Section of Women's, Children's, and Family Health. And I'll be talking about a recent project that I did comparing two systems for surveillance of neonatal abstinence syndrome in Alaska. I wanted to acknowledge that I had lots of help for this project from colleagues in my NCHEPI unit, as well as the staff of the hospital discharge database in Alaska, and many other colleagues who reviewed the work. Neonatal abstinence syndrome was a new topic for me when I started this, so I thought I would give a little bit of overview for you all, in case you're not familiar with it, on what it is. So it's a drug withdrawal syndrome that occurs after an in utero exposure to opioids, which could be heroin, prescription drugs, or other illicit substances. Not all infants who are exposed to opioids develop neonatal abstinence syndrome. For those who do, it's this withdrawal syndrome that usually becomes apparent in the first few days of life, and there's symptoms such as irritability, poor sucking reflex, poor weight gain. In some of the most severe cases, they might have experienced seizures. The long-term consequences for the infant are generally unknown, but they could include potential poor health, social, and behavioral outcomes. Several studies have been showing that there's been an increase over the past 15 or so years nationally in neonatal abstinence syndrome, and this has been associated also with a national increase in prenatal opioid use. Neonatal abstinence syndrome, as you can imagine, it is expensive to treat the infants. Most of them end up, or at least those with the severe symptoms, end up in the NICU. And one national study found that in 2013, more than 20% of all NICU days were attributed to the care of infants with neonatal abstinence syndrome. So the first data source that I went to look at this was the hospital discharge database, or the also known as the state inpatient database. This is what's most commonly used, both for a lot of the national data as well as in other states, to look at neonatal abstinence syndrome. However, there are some limitations with this data in Alaska. It's only available for 2001 through 2012. It doesn't include individual identifiers. And because hospital reporting was not made mandatory until 2015, it's not fully representative of the entire state. So the graph here shows the percent of all births per year that were represented in the hospital discharge data set, or those which occurred at the hospitals that were reporting during those years. So for the early years, it was over 75% of births, but then as some hospitals stopped reporting, it dropped to below 70% of all births that were represented in the system. So when I initially looked at this, I looked at the ICD-9 and ICD-10 codes for drug withdrawal syndrome in the newborn. These are 779.5 is the ICD-9 code, which I used for most of this. I excluded reports of cases that occurred more than 28 days after birth. And then I wanted to evaluate some exclusion criteria to identify iatrogenic NAS. This is cases that could have occurred due to the use of therapeutic drugs for infants that had complex medical conditions when they were born. And some studies, the one I cite here, kind of laid out a system for identifying these infants using cases where the infant had very low birth weight, less than 1,500 grams, or one of a few complex medical conditions, which I'll mention later. And then we did a trend analysis using negative binomial regression. This shows our initial findings for the NAS rates in Alaska compared to the U.S. So the rates, as you can see, they were clearly increasing. They went from 0.8 per 1,000 live births in 2001 to 5.1 per 1,000 live births in 2012. This was a significant increase. It was also very close to what the national numbers that have been reported in papers were also showing.
So I wasn't sure how many of these might have been misidentified or misclassified as NAS and would be excluded when I applied the criteria that Patrick et al. Had laid out in this paper. So I went through and tried to identify the cases that were very low birth weight. And so because there's no identifying information in our hospital discharge data, I couldn't link it to birth certificate data. So I had to use some proxy information from that was available in the HDD. So there's several ICD codes that indicate birth weight, not just low birth weight, but any type of birth weight. There's a whole series of those that I went through to look for whether the different the cases had one of these ICD codes. And then I also looked at the diagnosis-related group code. There's one in particular that identifies cases of more than 37 weeks gestation and more than 2,500 gram term neonate with problems. So if a case had that code, I knew it was not a very low birth weight. So out of the, there were 372 HDD cases over that 12-year period, and I was able to identify proxy information on birth weight for 346, or 93% of them. And seven of those were very low birth weight, so it was a very small number. Next, I looked at the possible, other cases of possible iatrogenic NAS from these complex medical conditions listed here. So out of all of these, I found 9 cases that had one of these conditions. So overall, 14 cases met at least one exclusion criteria. It wasn't very many cases, and when I redid the trend excluding those, it didn't change the trend at all. So because of those limitations that I mentioned of our hospital discharge data, we wanted to look to see whether, in particular, we could find something that was more timely. We really wanted to look at the more recent trends. So we decided to look at our Medicaid claims database. We also knew or thought that this had some potential for NAS because 78% of the hospital discharge database identified cases indicated that Medicaid was the primary payer. We had Medicaid data available through the current date. If any of you are comparing to the abstract, I actually updated what's shown here, went through the end of the year. So I was able to go through December 2015, which is a couple extra months from what I had submitted in the abstract. 53% of births in Alaska are Medicaid eligible, and this didn't really change over the time period of available data. The one other big bonus of Medicaid was that it had identifying information which would allow us to link it to the birth certificate. So kind of going to the question in the previous presentation, I was the one, in this case, I did the match with our birth certificate. And in Alaska, because there weren't that many cases, so I identified 231 Medicaid cases with NAS. So I did an exact match on name and date of birth, and then did some manual hand matching and was able to link 90% of our cases to an Alaska birth certificate. First, I want to show one of the variables on the birth certificate that we were interested in was prenatal care utilization. So this graph compares the Medicaid NAS infants to all Medicaid eligible births just in 2014, our most recent year of birth data, and then all 2014 Alaska resident births. So it was clear that these Medicaid NAS infants were definitely higher risk. The moms were higher risk. That was no surprise. They had a higher percentage of no prenatal care as well as inadequate prenatal care. According to I use the Kottlechuk Index, which combines information from the timing of prenatal care and the number of visits that the mother has during her pregnancy. And so 41% of these NAS infants had either no or inadequate prenatal care, which indicated to us that interventions to either educate moms about the risks of opioid use during prenatal care may not reach quite a few of these at-risk moms. And also, if somebody was trying to do screening to identify infants potentially at risk for NAS, they might miss quite a few if they only focus on trying to reach women during prenatal care visits. So we had a big lesson learned with this project. As I mentioned, this was my first time using Medicaid data. And I was at a session a few days ago where somebody mentioned how important it is to communicate with the person doing the query of Medicaid. And when we initially, when I initially had the Medicaid query pulled, it turns out that the person doing that query only pulled NAS cases if it was the primary diagnosis. And in Medicaid, there's actually up to, I think it's 24, at least in Alaska, 24 different or potential codes for a single claim. And so this graph shows in the, the gray is the hospital discharge, the number of cases per year, and then the light green is the Medicaid using just the principal code, and then the dark green is when we revised our Medicaid numbers and included all of those potential codes. So it's actually quite different. It almost doubled the number of NAS cases that we identified per year. We also saw both in Medicaid and hospital discharge this clear increase, and it looked like it was increasing even faster in the last couple of years. Another thing of interest here was in 2012, Medicaid actually identified more cases than the hospital discharge data, which could be a reflection that the hospital discharge wasn't really statewide by that time. So some limitations were that neither data source completely represents the entire Alaska birth population. As well, ICD codes can't distinguish between appropriately prescribed opioid use, abuse of prescription drugs, and use of illicit drugs, which is kind of a limitation when you're trying to think about how to intervene and prevent these cases. There's potential for misclassification because data are based on the billing codes rather than a confirmed diagnosis, so it could go either way. We could be including including false cases and missing true cases. Some of the increase over the last couple of years could be due to providers being more aware of the syndrome, more awareness just of the opioid crisis in general. And also there were revisions to the American Academy of Pediatrics NAS diagnostic guidelines in 2012, and we're still trying to figure out how that might have impacted the increases in particular in the last couple of years. Finally, we did feel like both the Medicaid and the HDD data clearly show that this burden on our healthcare system, caring for NAS infants, has increased over the past several years. For surveillance of neonatal abstinence syndrome in Alaska, we feel that currently Medicaid is the preferred source of data because it's more timely, it does encompass a large percentage of our at-risk population, and we can link the records to the birth certificate. We felt like if we're just trying to establish a baseline, look at how the trend was changing, we felt that Medicaid really could give us a good idea of that. However, the hospital discharge data does allow us to compare to national rates, and we're hoping that the representativeness might improve with the 2015 data. It was made mandatory for hospitals to report to RHDD in 2015, so we'll be interested to see how the numbers look once we get that data. We felt that the exclusion criteria for anyone who's interested in looking at NAS in their state, it was, in particular on the HDD, it was complicated for us to apply because of the lack of birth weight information, and it didn't really change the interpretation of the trend, so we kind of felt like it was a lot of work for not a lot of gain. And that's all that I have. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Shayla Livingston from Vermont. Thank you for your presentation. I do this work in Vermont, and I've done it both in our hospital and Medicaid data. And two things that I'm very curious about, and I don't know if you've been able to explore or thought about exploring, are one, being able to try to figure out a way to determine in Medicaid claims whether or not the infant was treated pharmacologically. So that can give you a better sense of the severity of the NAS. In Vermont, I have a hypothesis that a lot of our NAS infants are actually just exposed and don't even maybe score on the scale. But I'm really trying to find the codes that would tell me whether or not that infant was treated, because that could maybe help determine that. So that's one question, if you've done that or thought of that or figured that out. And then the other one is a big deal for us is whether or not the women were in medication-assisted treatment and trying to determine that. And in 2010, one of our other analysts connected moms to babies through vital records and Medicaid claims, and I was actually able to look at, of those babies born, the number of moms who were in treatment. And our rates in 2010 were really high. It was 4 out of 5. And so that was sort of reassuring. And I don't know if you have been able to do that, but that's one way to potentially get at that. Were they using illicit drugs or were they in treatment?
Thank you. Yeah, those are great comments. For the first issue, we haven't really looked at that yet, but I'm meeting with a group of local healthcare providers. There's a perinatal collaborative here in Anchorage, and I'm actually meeting with them tomorrow and hoping to discuss some of those types of issues, because it's hard for conditions like this where we're not treating the cases and we don't always know what are the ICD codes that people are using. So that is something that I'm hoping to talk with them about tomorrow, but it's not something I don't have an answer right now for you on that. For the second thing, yes, we did think about linking to the mom's information, and we are planning to do that, especially now that we have it was really only a month ago or so that we realized that we hadn't captured all of the NAS cases, that our Medicaid query was wrong. So we're just now finishing up linking to the birth certificate. And yeah, I hope that we will be able to go and then link to the mother's Medicaid information and get more information on her prenatal exposures.
Actually, I have a question. Can you talk a little bit about how you made the hospital discharge data mandatory?
It was in our legislature last year, yeah, and I wasn't really involved, so I don't really know how they managed to do that.
Any other questions? For those of you sitting down in the back, there's a whole row of empty seats up front. A couple of them, actually, if you want to come up front. Thanks, Bergen.